Radio.Dominican.edu is the official radio station here at Dominican University of California, broadcasting live from Angelico Hall. ILS lecture, A Big History with Robert Bella, coming up in just moments. Right here, worldwide, on Radio.Dominican.edu.
Good evening. Welcome to Dominican's Leadership Lecture Series. My name is Luis Calingo, and I'm the Executive Vice President and Chief Academic Officer of this university. It is my pleasure to welcome Dr. Robert Neely Bella back to Dominican. Dr. Bella is the Elliott Professor of Sociology Emeritus at UC Berkeley. The great Harvard sociologist Talcott Parsons was his intellectual parent. Dr. Bella is also best known for his work on American civil religion, for which he has written his latest book entitled Religion and Human Evolution. The first time that Dr. Bella spoke on our campus was the night of the Loma Prieta earthquake in 1989. Now, despite the widespread damage caused by that earthquake, Dr. Bella made his way to Dominican to deliver his lecture. So, it is reasonable for you to expect an earthshaker tonight. Now, by the way, the last earthquake that hit Marin had its epicenter in Berkeley and hit us last October, right after we had our campus earthquake drill. So, given these facts, I think we will be okay tonight. Now, the Leadership Lecture Series is a program of the Institute for Leadership Studies, which is a center for leadership development. Now on its eighth year, the Institute hosts public forums to engage students, the campus, and the community in socially relevant discussions inspired by effective leaders in a variety of disciplines. The series features leaders in the worlds of business, politics, literature, psychology, civil rights, and entertainment. These lectures highlight acts of leadership across disciplines and invite our campus community and the Bay Area community to engage together around powerful ideas and sponsors and actions. This academic year, the Leadership Lecture Series' lead sponsor is Private Ocean. Private Ocean is owned by Dominican University trustee Mr. Richard Stone. Private Ocean is one of the oldest and largest privately held wealth management firms in Marin. So please join me in thanking Private Ocean and Richard Stone for supporting our important lecture series. Tonight's program, featuring Dominican's Big History first-year experience, has additional partners and sponsors. Thank you to sponsors from the following offices of Dominican University: the School of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences, the Office of Academic Affairs, and Campus Ministry. We are also proud and honored to welcome our partners and their guests from the Dominican Sisters of San Rafael, the Santa Sabina Center, and the Marin Interfaith Council. Also, please join me in thanking Dominican students and staff for volunteering to serve as ushers and greeters this evening. Now, we certainly have an exciting series planned this spring, and upcoming speakers include Eve Ensler in conversation with Isabel Allende, the former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm, the author Anne Lamott, and author Michael David Lucas in cooperation with One Book, One Marin. Information about all our upcoming lectures can be found in our lecture series pamphlet, okay? And copies are available in the lobby, or please feel free to just ask one of our ushers for a copy. Now tonight, Dr. Bella will be in conversation with Dominican's Dr. Harlan Stelmach, Professor of Humanities. Harlan's disciplinary expertise includes religion and ethics. Harlan studied under Dr. Bella as a graduate student at the Graduate Theological Union. And recently, Harlan organized a graduate humanities seminar at Dominican using the early drafts of Dr. Bella's new book. Tonight's program is part of the Big History First Year Experience program here at Dominican. And Dr. Mojgan Beaumont, Director of General Education and First Year Experience at Dominican, will provide us a context of the Big History program. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Mojgan Beaumont.
Good evening, and a warm welcome to all, and a special welcome to our first year students. I saw quite a few of you out there. I'm Mojgan Beaumont. I'm Associate Professor of English and Director of First Year Experience Big History. Tonight's event is part of our year-long curriculum in Big History, a unique program that takes the participants on an immense journey through time, almost 14 billion years of it, to witness the Big Bang and the first moments of our universe, to the birth and death of stars and planets and the formation of life on Earth. We observe the development of the web of life and the dawn of human consciousness, and follow the ever-unfolding story of humans as Earth's dominant species. In studying the history of our universe, we seek to understand ourselves and to engage with fundamental questions regarding our momentous role in shaping possible futures for our planet. Dr. Bella's talk tonight, which focuses on the role of religion in solving our problems, is a wonderful fit for our program. To those who see Big History merely as a science and history course, the topic of this talk may come as a surprise. Let us keep in mind that Big History came to Dominican in the 1980s via Thomas Berry, a priest. And I hear that the Dominican sisters' admiration for him and his universe story, as he called Big History, went so far as to have the sisters name a feline resident of the Santa Sabina Center, a cat, T. Berry. Here at Dominican, we are in the process of learning and sharing with our students a new story, which we hope will come to define us as a community and as a people. On a daily basis, we discover that we need a profound story, a story that is not made up merely of facts and dates, that a story must have a soul. Dr. Bella's work responds to that need. Before I leave the stage, I'd like to introduce and welcome Richard Stone, CEO of Private Ocean, our lead sponsor for the evening. Because we might be doing the wonderful work of telling the new story, but it is with support such as his that our work becomes possible. Mr. Stone is also a member of Dominican University's Board of Trustees and has served as a leader in the wealth management business for more than 40 years. He is co-founder of Private Ocean, one of the oldest and largest privately held companies, wealth management firms in Marin, and has been named as one of the top 100 registered investment advisors nationwide 7 times by Worth Magazine. The San Francisco Business Times names Private Ocean number 4 of top 25 independent registered investment advisors in the Bay Area for firm quality, as well as assets under management. In November 2011, Richard Stone was awarded the prestigious Charles Schwab Impact Leadership Award for his lifetime contributions to the financial planning industry. On behalf of the university and our program, I'd like to express our gratitude to Private Ocean for its generous support. And ladies and gentlemen, Richard Stone.
Thank you very much. As a trustee of Dominican University, it gives me great pleasure to welcome you to the Leadership Lecture Series featuring this engaging Big History conversation. Welcome to our freshman students in the audience who are involved in Dominican's Big History General Education Program, and we have some other guests this evening, a Professor Ted Peters and a group of students that he has from GTU. Also welcome. Private Ocean is honored to help support this fine educational and community program. This evening, I'm delighted to introduce one of the world's greatest living sociologists of religion, Dr. Robert Bella. Dr. Bella graduated summa cum laude from the Harvard College with a BA in social anthropology in 1950. In 1955, he received a PhD from Harvard University in sociology and Far Eastern languages. After 2 years of postdoctoral work in his Islamic studies at McGill University in Montreal, he began teaching at Harvard in 1957, and after 10 years, moved to the University of California at Berkeley as a professor of sociology. For 30 years, Dr. Bella served as Ford Professor of Sociology at Berkeley. Today, he is the Elliott Professor of Sociology Emeritus. Among Dr. Bella's many works are Beyond Belief, The Broken Covenant, The Good Society, Habits of the Heart, Imagining Japan, and the Robert Bella Reader. In 2000, Dr. Bella received the United States National Humanities Medal. The citation which President Clinton signed reads, "The President of the United States of America awards this National Humanities Medal to Dr. Bella for his efforts to illuminate the importance of community in American society." This evening, Dr. Bella will talk with us about his newest book, Religion in Human Evolution, the result of his lifetime interest in the evolution of religion and 13 years of work in this volume. Ladies and gentlemen and students, please welcome Dr. Robert Bella.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and I sincerely hope it will not precipitate another earthquake. I know some of you have read chapters from my book, and I will be going over some of the ground that you may be familiar with, but as someone told me a long time ago, if they hear it a second time, they'll get more out of it. So we hope so. I want to start with two comments that are kind of significant for how we think about the universe we live in at this moment in history. The first is from Albert Einstein, who said, "The most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible." Steven Weinberg, a Nobel Prize-winning physicist considerably younger than Albert Einstein, made a comment that seems clearly an answer to Einstein when he said, "The more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it seems pointless." Although my book on religion and human evolution contains 12 studies of particular societies focusing on their religious beliefs and practices, I set my story in the framework of cosmological and biological history, what has come to be called big history, which I'm very happy to know is well regarded and widely popular on this campus. Chapter 2 in my book, one of the longest chapters, gives an overview of that story of the development of the universe and of life on our planet. I chose that framework as it is the one educated people can agree on and take seriously, whatever other stories are important to them, and thus it provides a framework for the comparative study of religion. It is important to remember that that story is the achievement of science, and we must respect it as such. It is inevitable that that story will be given a meaning that cannot be derived from science, and we clearly have at present conflicting versions of what that story means. I want to reflect on the conflicting versions by referring to my two epigraphs. I think everything important in the world is always the cause of conflict, so it's not surprising that there's hardly unanimity when it comes to something this important. When Einstein said, "The most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible,"
He was saying something of the greatest importance. We now know that the universe in which we live began 13.7 billion years ago, had a tumultuous cosmological history that led up to the formation of our Earth 4.5 billion years ago, and the beginnings of life perhaps 3.8 billion years ago with the emergence of the prokaryotes, single-celled organisms, commonly called bacteria, that to this day are the most numerous forms of life in number of species and total biomass. From that beginning, after a very long period of time, there emerged complex single-celled organisms called eukaryotes, with a nucleus containing the DNA that simply floated loosely in prokaryotes. We are eukaryotes, since all multicellular organisms are formed of them, but it took a long time to get to us. Hominids are only a few million years old. Homo sapiens began to speciate perhaps 250,000 years ago. Modern humans with full cultural capabilities are only 150,000 years old, or according to some people, considerably younger than that. If you look at biological history, we are a very young species. Of course, 100,000 years doesn't seem brief to us, but biological time, it's a flick of the eyelid. What are we to make of this incomprehensible comprehensibility? At least two things. The universe is unspeakably old, and the physical and biological processes leading to us extraordinarily complex. Beings who now begin to, and that's the first thing. The second thing is, beings who now begin to understand this whole amazing story, that is us, are here. I would say that the Big Bang and the presence of us are the two most important and equally remarkable things we can know from this story. Science gives us this story. What we make of it is no longer science, though for human beings, making something of it is irresistible. I have spoken in chapter 2 of my book of cosmic optimists and cosmic pessimists. Both tell the same story, but give it very different interpretations. I think we can learn from both of them, but we must resist simple affirmations of either. Above all, neither story can replace the many other stories that have arisen in the course of human evolution and that still have much to teach us. At one point in that same chapter, I call my book A Story of Stories, and I take all of them from the tribal peoples to the most recent speculations about the universe with the greatest seriousness. Let me speak briefly of the cosmic optimist story. In my book, I used Eric Chasen's cosmic evolution as an example. But here let me turn to Thomas Berry, who called his story the new story. Here is a summarizing paragraph from Berry's new story. If the dynamics of the universe from the beginning shaped the course of the heavens, lighted the sun and formed the earth, if this same dynamism brought forth the continents and seas and atmosphere, if it awakened life in the primordial cell and then brought into being the unnumbered variety of living beings and finally brought us into being and guided us safely through the turbulent centuries, there is reason to believe that this same guiding process is precisely what has awakened in us our present understanding of ourselves and our relation to this stupendous process. Sensitized to such guidance from the very structure and functioning of the universe, we can have confidence in the future that awaits the human venture. So much from Thomas Berry. Very moving words. In this version, however, we are not entirely in the realm of science, though it draws from science. The dynamics of the universe are doing quite a bit more than any scientist could affirm, in Berry's words. Loosely speaking, such dynamics might be said to have shaped, lighted, and brought forth, but I think no scientist as a scientist could possibly affirm that they guided us safely through the turbulent centuries. Remembering, among other things, that at the end of the last ice age, the human species was reduced to as few as 10,000 individuals, whose continuation was precarious indeed. Today we would have called them an endangered species. Us, the great us, were almost eliminated not so long ago. It is quite possible that we could have gone extinct then, and we would not be here today to discuss it. Cosmological and biological evolution is marked by too many major catastrophes for us to be so confident that the dynamics of the universe are going to take care of us. That's the part of Barry's statement that I find I can't go along with. I think when he speaks of dynamics of the universe, he is really speaking of the Christian idea of providence. But indeed, even the Christian idea of providence, which perhaps lies behind such an assertion, is itself too profoundly mysterious, affirming as it does that God's ways are not our ways, to allow us to be so confident as Barry seems to be. If we cannot say that the development of evolution that ends with us was necessary or inevitable, we cannot say either that it was just due to chance, though we can't rule that out. All we can truly say, if we are in the realm of science, is that evolution had the possibility of leading to us. After all, we are here. We must have been possible. But many scientists of great stature believe that we are here by chance and agree with Steven Weinberg when he said, in his obvious revision of Einstein's remark, the following about the comprehensibility of the universe. However all these problems may be resolved, and whichever cosmological model proves correct, says Weinberg, there is not much comfort in any of this. It is almost irresistible for humans to believe that we have some special relation to the universe, that human life is not just a more or less farcical outcome of a chain of accidents reaching back to the first 3 minutes. Weinberg wrote a famous book about the first 3 minutes of the universe. But that, Weinberg goes on, we were somehow built in from the beginning. It is hard to realize that this Earth is just a tiny part of an overwhelmingly hostile universe. It is even harder to realize that the present universe has evolved from an unspeakably unfamiliar early condition and faces a future extinction of endless cold or intolerable heat. The more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it seems pointless. I may say that Weinberg has overstepped the bounds of science just as much as Barry did, in a different direction. Science doesn't say anything about the universe being hostile. It's a highly anthropomorphic idea. Our good friend Richard Dawkins seconds Weinberg quite eloquently when he writes, "The universe we observe has precisely the properties we would expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference." Hello. I think people can be indifferent. I don't think the universe can be indifferent. Nonetheless, Dawkins, as you know, has quite a reputation. One of the great founders of molecular biology, Jacques Monod, rounds out the picture with a vivid image. Monod writes, "It is perfectly true that science attacks values, not directly, since science is no judge of them and must ignore them, but it subverts every one of the mythical or philosophical ontogenies upon which the animist tradition, from the Australian Aborigines to the dialectical materialists, has based morality, values, duties, rights, prohibitions. If he accepts this message in its full significance, man must at last wake out of his millenary dream and discover his total solitude, his fundamental isolation. He must realize that, like a gypsy, he lives on the boundary of an alien world, a world that is deaf to his music, and as indifferent to his hopes as it is to his sufferings or his crimes." Now, you can figure out whether that statement is purely scientific or not. What I've tried to do in my second chapter is avoid either the cosmic optimist story, in which we are safely guided to our present existence, or the cosmic pessimist story, in which the whole thing is utterly meaningless. It seems to me that the former story, so far as it claims to be a scientific story, makes too much of the fact that we humans exist, whereas the cosmic pessimist story doesn't take that fact seriously enough. I argue in my book that the fact that we are here is as important as the fact that the universe exists. and that even staying within the world of science, it is undeniable that we are part of the universe and a very special part at that. Every subatomic particle in our bodies was created in the Big Bang. Every cell in our body is descended from those first forms of life, the bacteria, and our genes overlap those of the bacteria significantly to this day. That would seem to allow us, with all humility, to claim that we are at home in the universe because we are totally part of it. I cited Oliver Sacks and Marcus Aurelius for holding this modest view, which does not go beyond the bounds of science, in either a triumphalist or a nihilist direction. And we can say one thing more. We are the only part of the universe, as far as we know. There could be some others that we don't or aren't aware of, who know we are part of the universe. A universe 13.7 billion years old, and the story of how we got from the Big Bang to us, though we have only known this story very recently, since the Big Bang and its approximate date was only discovered in 1927 and took some decades to be widely accepted. Still, however probable or accidental, the fact that we do know this is, to my mind, as important as the Big Bang itself. Of course, I would like to combat scientific nihilism and spend my time affirming, if not the scientific necessity, at least this scientific wonder of who we are. Language and culture is indisputably an evolutionary advance that counts among the great evolutionary transitions, which we are now widely accepted by biologists as having marked evolutionary history. But I'm afraid that I feel obligated to combat evolutionary triumphalism before returning not to optimism, for which I see few grounds, but hope. Hope is a theological virtue and comes from one of the many traditions that we still need in spite of the prestige of the scientific story. The first point to remember before we get too confident about being safely guided to our present condition is that the history of the universe is full of extraordinary catastrophes. The Big Bang itself was an unimaginably gigantic explosion of such heat and speed that no life could have survived it, though of course life would only emerge billions of years later. The formation of stars and galaxies was no picnic either. Explosions of supernovas, very large, very hot stars, can generate a tremendous amount of energy as they send out their particles that made them up out into space. The explosion of a supernova can be the source of solar systems, and our own solar system is probably the result of just such an explosion. As planets begin to form from the detritus of the explosion, the result is anything but quiet. The landscape of the early Earth, if we even call it a landscape, would be characterized by constantly falling matter, building up the bulk of our planet, massive volcanic explosions as our planet formed a molten core. Things got quieter after a few hundred million years, but the Earth on which life first appeared was nothing like what we see around us. Life appeared first in the oceans, and the dry land was just rocks and volcanoes. Stephen Jay Gould and Lynn Margulis, among other well-known biologists, have celebrated these first organisms to emerge from the non-organic matter of which the early Earth was composed in ways that are still don't understand. How did life begin? There are quite a few theories nobody really knows. These are the amazing bacteria, so wonderfully viable that they have survived and prospered beyond any other kind of organism. We give them a bad name because a few of them are rather nasty. But you know, we have 1 trillion cells in our body, and we have 10 trillion bacteria in our body. So don't get hysterical when somebody says, oh, there's bacteria there. There's bacteria everywhere. This is on your skin. Quite a few thousand bacteria on every square inch of your thin skin. So please, be kind. Think more charitably of this enormously important species, or a group of species. And Stephen Jay Gould, who really loved bacteria, it's hard, a little hard to see how you could actually love them, but he seemed to, he said of them, these are the organisms that were in the beginning are now and probably ever shall be, until the sun runs out of fuel, the dominant creatures on Earth, by any standard evolutionary criterion of biochemical diversity, range of habitats, resistance to extinction, and perhaps even in biomass. Gould then goes on to say, the tree of life is effectively a bacterial bush. The two of the three domains, bacteria and archaea, belong to the prokaryotes alone. While the three kingdoms of multicellular eukaryotes, plants, animals, and fungi, appear as three twigs on the terminus of the third domain. Gould always wanted to bring us down to Earth, and remember, we are a very strange and very small part of the totality of life on this planet. However we might want to celebrate the vertebrates, mammals, and primates that lead up to us, we must remember how much we owe the bacteria. We might also remember how many, how many of them are inside us. There are our friends right there working for us right now. We hope they're not any of the really bad ones there, but that they could be. Lynn Margulis has written, the age of the bacteria transformed the Earth from a cratered moon-like terrain of volcanic glassy rocks into the fertile planet in which we make our home. They did this, however, by causing a tremendous catastrophe. The early Earth had an atmosphere of gases, some of which in large doses, such as carbon dioxide, would be poisonous to us, but only a tiny amount of oxygen, less than 0.0001%. However, over 2 billion years ago, one bacteria species, the ancestors of present-day cyanobacteria, evolved a remarkable new form of making a living, what we call photosynthesis, by which they could use sunlight, water, and carbon dioxide to create a superabundant supply of food, since there was virtually an endless supply of these ingredients. Cyanobacteria took advantage of their new discovery to spread rapidly through all the Earth's oceans. The process by which they produced food from these ingredients involves splitting the water molecules to get the hydrogen from them, but releasing the oxygen molecules as waste. This caused a rapid rise in the percentage of oxygen in the atmosphere to something close to the 21% it is now. But in so doing, they wiped out a huge portion of the Earth's anaerobic inhabitants, that is, organisms adapted to an atmosphere without oxygen, what was likely the largest extinction event in the history of the Earth. So, as so often in evolution, thank you on the one hand, but God help the poor people that are going to pay for it on the other hand. Even though they were single-celled animals, they were obliterated. They literally blew up. Oxygen is flammable. If you're not adapted to it, watch out. Eventually, no later than 1 billion years ago, some oxygen-producing cyanobacteria formed a symbiosis with single-celled eubacteria called protists, producing the ancestors of plants and algae. So we have the oxygen-producing cyanobacteria to thank for all the products of photosynthesis on which we and all metazoa, that is all animals, depend for food. Lynn Margulis, the great scholar of these small creatures, goes so far as to say that we are, and our animal friends, parasites on the cyanobacteria. We cannot make our food out of sunlight and water and carbon. We need the cyanobacteria to do that for us. That technically makes us parasites. We're living on another creature without whom we would die. In short, if all the bacteria in the world should die tonight, human beings would live only a few days. We can't make our own food. And no animal other could make it food, because the plants would die, and we'd be left in an oxygenless atmosphere. It would not be good. However, if the human species should disappear, the bacteria wouldn't blink an eye. Of course, they have no eye to blink. But if they had an eye, they wouldn't blink it, because They don't depend on us. We depend on them. All our proudness, all our culture, all our writing, all our wonderful things. And yet, we'd be nowhere without these people. We'd be nowhere without the whole 4 billion years of the history of life on this planet. We would never have even come into existence. I tried to signal at various points in my book, though we may not unjustly think of ourselves as at some kind of pinnacle in evolutionary history, we are there quite precariously, and we owe a great deal to creatures, including the very simplest, upon which we completely depend. I could develop the theme by discussing the largest group of multicellular organisms, the insects. Again, we don't like insects. We need insects. They pollinate, they make the earth fertile. Where would we be without the insects? It's almost like where we would be without the cyanobacteria. So please, again, think again when you swat that fly. This is an enormously large group of organisms, the largest group of multicellular of creatures around. They're fascinating. They're fascinating because, unlike bacteria, they have brains. And we are now beginning to really understand, because of incredible developments in electronic microscopes, their brains are so small. This is nanotechnology, I mean, at the most amazing degree. We think of insects as totally programmed genetically by instinct and so on. No way. Like all life, they have a kind of consciousness, they have a kind of ability to be creative, to respond creatively to their environment. They are not pre-programmed by genes and instincts. Everything alive is sentient, can learn in the face of new conditions, and participates actively in its own evolution. All life is creative. We have no monopoly on that. The downside of this story is that, with all our amazing achievements, we are remarkably fragile. We are, as I show in the book, megafauna, that is, very large organisms, relative to most organisms, really large, with a very high energy need, and it is especially our brains that take so many calories, so why we have to eat so much. The brains don't weigh that much, but they sure need a lot of fuel. Like all higher mammals, we are vulnerable to the second law of thermodynamics because we are far more complex than simpler organisms. And the more complex, the harder to manage and the easier to fall apart. But when you add culture, especially modern culture, our vulnerability becomes truly alarming. I have put in my book a great many warnings, subtle or not so subtle, to that effect. I've been challenged by some commentators in my book to say more about adaptation and maladaptation, the common currency of natural selection. So let me go beyond the numerous hints in my book to discuss explicitly some concerns about natural selection when it comes to humans. One of the measures of adaptation is increase in offspring. To put it simply, the more you reproduce, the more you succeed in what Darwin called the struggle for existence. Let us look for a moment about some interesting facts about human population. At about the beginning of the Common Era, there were, it is estimated, about 250 million humans on this earth. It was not until 1500 that population doubled to 500 million. To double in 1,500 years, oh, that looks good now, doesn't it? However, from 1,500 to 1,800, population doubled again to reach 1 billion. Doubling in 300 years is a lot faster than doubling in 1,500 years. But what is interesting is it had nothing to do with modernization or industrialization, which didn't exist in 1800. This increase was almost wholly due to what is called the Atlantic Exchange. That is, the many new plants that the European discoverers of what was to them a new world brought back to Eurasia. The most important of these were potatoes and corn, not only high in calories, but they will grow in soil where wheat and rice cannot grow, thus increasing output without decreasing the native staples. And so population grew worldwide. But after 1800, something remarkable begins to happen, which is clearly related to modernization and industrialization. Population doubles again between 1800 and 1927. Faster than ever, but still slow in terms of what was coming. I was born in 1927 when the world's population reached 2 billion. Last October, when I was 84, the world's population reached 7 billion. 3.5 times in my lifetime. And if I live even a few more years, I could see it reach 8 billion, and so quadruple in my lifetime. How marvelous, how adaptive, what an achievement we have made in outproducing any possible rivals for our primacy. Or is it? Most scientists in the world today believe that this enormously rapid increase in population and the geometric increase in the use of energy that made it possible are signs of profound vulnerability, have already crossed the line of sustainability where the costs are outrunning the benefits. Remember that 99.9% of all species have gone extinct and that it is the simpler ones that have survived the longest. How can we affirm cosmic optimism when our species seems on the verge of creating not only its own extinction, but the extinction of a great many of the larger multicellular organisms as well? The bacteria will probably do fine, as Stephen Jay Gould has noted. And even in a couple of billion more years, give rise to another try to develop large-scale creatures. That can hardly reassure the cosmic optimists. In short, there is nothing in the history of evolution that can assure us that we will inevitably survive and prosper, given what we have done to the Earth in the last 200 years. If we look to the scientists to reassure us, we will find them shaking their heads, furious with what is going on and our unwillingness to do anything about it. Having, I hope, shown that cosmic optimism is unwarranted, let me say just a word against cosmic pessimism. I want to contest especially Jacques Monod's assertion that man must wake up to, quote, discover his total solitude, his fundamental isolation. Of course, Monod is arguing that it is as the only reflectively conscious species that we know that we are alone. But I have argued the second most important thing about the universe after the Big Bang itself is that we know about it and everything since. Yet, besides the point I made earlier on the idea that everything in our bodies comes from subatomic particles in the Big Bang and we descend from unicellular organisms that arose billions of years ago, we did not gain our cultural consciousness all of a sudden out of nothing. You know, Monod lived at the same time as Jean-Paul Sartre, and you can see his statement has Sartrean philosophy more than biology. The notion that we are alone and isolated and we can't count on anything is pure Sartre. It's also very common in this country right now. It's part of modernity, but it's not science. We can argue that primitive consciousness, what some biologists call sentience, and purpose of action are coterminous with life itself, even long before there were animals that had developed brains. And we now know that insects, far from being totally programmed, have the most amazingly complex brains. Even Darwin said, a little dose of judgment or reason often comes into play, even in animals very low in the scale of nature. So when nobody else said so, Darwin said, these insects are damn smart. He was ahead of the time as usual. And we have learned rather recently that among some mammals and birds, the practice of parental care of helpless offspring, there have emerged the capacity for empathy, even cross-species empathy, as well as ethics and politics. Thus it turns out that our extraordinary capacities of cultural consciousness arose and could only have arisen from billions of years of the evolution of consciousness. We express the consciousness of life, the consciousness of the universe, of which we are part, and from which we have come. In that sense, we are not alone. We are very much part of a huge process without which we couldn't exist for one second. But just because we have arisen from the whole process of evolution, we are still subject to the pressures of evolution, which go on apace as much as ever in the realm of culture and consciousness itself. We, as is all life, are subject to natural selection, before which we are not supine, but in which we, like all life, but with special powers, which we will see are both our strength and our weakness, participate and have an influence. We tend to think of natural selection as the struggle for existence, the term Darwin himself used, or even the term survival of the fittest, which Darwin, after long hesitation, adopted from Herbert Spencer. We see two male lions fighting it out on the savannah to see which will propagate more offspring than the other and therefore contribute to a stronger line. Or we see two species struggling over the same territory to see which will replace the other. There is truth in these images, though not the whole truth. We need to see selection going on simultaneously at several levels, and we also need to add what Darwin saw only glancingly, that cooperation is also indispensable as an element of natural selection, so struggle is never the whole story. Stephen Jay Gould has pointed out that natural selection goes on many levels. We think of it as taking place above all at the level of individuals, by which we mean organisms. But Gould says that individuals exist at every level, that the level down from them is their parts, and the level above them, their society. No one level is privileged. The genes are individuals, and selection can go on at that level, though not as exclusively as Dawkins argued in The Selfish Gene. But genetic selection is surely part of the story. The cells are individuals, as are, of course, organisms. But groups are also individuals in this context of natural selection. And there really is such a thing as group selection, as Darwin himself believed when he argued that groups that had more altruists would, quote, defeat groups that had fewer. This was long denied in 20th century biology, which focused on organismic selection alone, but species can also be individuals. They can certainly arise and can become extinct. Perhaps we could go beyond Gould and say the biosphere itself is also an individual that can succeed or fail. What has become a triumph of recent biology is the return to respectability of group selection, groups that cooperate, that are not riven with inner division, such as among humans, extreme income polarization, do better than groups that lack such cooperation. The bad news is that it is external threat that creates the strongest group cooperation and solidarity. And war is a wonderful means of creating such groups. In spite of Steven Pinker's argument about our better angels, war remains an enormous threat, not least the threat of war between the two most powerful nations on Earth, the United States and China. Just read the latest issue of the New York Review of Books for an article entitled, "The Chinese Are Coming. We'll Scare You to Death." Now, I was just in China, I'm not scared at all. To bring all this biology back home and to the history we are now making, we are now in the midst of intense natural selection pressures. Human species against all other species for scarce resources, as shown by our incredible population growth, interspecies conflict brought on by nationalism, and the struggle for dominance between nations, the weakness of cooperation in the fight against global warming, as indicated by the failure of Kyoto and Copenhagen, and the unwillingness to think of the common good within the most powerful nations, as each individual is encouraged to get the maximum and devil take the hindmost. A little parable here. We are multicellular animals. What does that mean? It means that we are made up of nothing but cells. Bone cells, nerve cells, blood cells. All these cells are descended from monocellular organisms that were once independent, that weren't part of a multicellular organism. And each of them has, shall we say, a little impulse to return to its past and make it on its own. To hell with the common good. All ourselves have been differentiated to do particular jobs. But natural selection tells each of them at some level, multiply as many replicas as possible. Displace and triumph over the other cells in your vicinity. Multicellular animals have involved control mechanisms for getting rid of such self-seekers, but they are not always effective and become weaker as we get older. No complex system can continue to exist without centralized control and management mechanisms. That seems to be denied in our culture at the moment. It's insane. The more complex, the more we need powerful mechanisms of control. What do we call such cells who decide to go it alone and replicate for the good of themselves and not for the common body? We call them cancer. Look at the list of obituaries in the Chronicle. How many people are dying as we speak? And Lynn Margolis points out, cancer is not a disease. Cancer is a regression. In one sense, a perfectly, quote, normal, unquote, regression of cells that are part of a body but have decided they're going to make it on their own. It's also a suicidal tactic. Because if the cancer is successful, it will kill the multicellular body that it is part of, and it will itself die. Cancer is suicidal, so is nationalism, so is radical individualism. What we need now is not just national solidarity, but species solidarity. And since we are so dependent on other species, not a selfish species solidarity, but one that goes on to embrace the solidarity of the entire biosphere. Should we fail in that? Should we bring down our own species and inevitably a lot of others with us, though not the bacteria? We would be committing social suicide, national suicide, species suicide, all of which are natural evolutionary processes. And there is no guiding mechanism to make sure we won't. If we could muster the intelligence and the solidarity to change global, to choose global cooperation instead of global suicide, that too would be because of natural evolutionary processes. We have the freedom and the creativity to do it. I have said nothing about religion all this time. I'm going to let Harlan bring that subject up. But let me just close briefly. Religion provides enormous resources for the move to global solidarity and peaceful coexistence within the biosphere, better ideas than perhaps any other sphere. Yet religion can also lead to suicidal conflict within and between the great traditions. We can see both things going on at the moment. Evolution is to some extent in our own hands. What will we choose to do? Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. I've heard sermons on religion before, but now I've heard a sermon on biology. So thank you for treating us to that journey. What I'd like to do is perhaps step back and set some context, though, for tonight, and have the audience know a little bit more about you and how you relate to our enterprise here of big history. So it appears from your writings, appears from all your lectures, appears from your work, you've spent a good bit of time on the topic of religion. So tell us a little bit about the interplay, perhaps, of your intellectual work on religion and your own personal involvement in the subject of religion. Where did that begin?
This was a question that was asked earlier in the other room, and I said it would take a long time to give the answer. So I have to think of how to give the highlights. The name Bella is a Scottish name. Sometimes it's considered to be an Arabic name because H at the end of a name can be Arabic. However, mine is simply Scottish, nothing as elegant as Arabic. Though I do get mailings from Islamic groups, which I think are reading my name wrong. Anyway, I'm getting to the point, really, and that is Scotland is the home of the Presbyterian Church. It has long been the established Church of Scotland. And my ancestors were Scottish Presbyterians and they were Calvinists. And I was raised in the Presbyterian Church. I went to Sunday school and so on. And I'm sure that had an impact, though at the time it didn't seem to be making much difference. I did have the marvelous experience in high school of having a high school minister whom the senior pastor had chosen without adequate inquiry, because this high school minister was a strong believer in the social gospel, and the pastor was the ultra-conservative, Southern California conservative. Anyway, he had us reading Amos and Hosea and Isaiah, and I was blown away. I thought, my God, this is really what's real. This is really important. And then it was very good for growing up in Los Angeles. Some of you may be from Los Angeles. I grew up there, so I can criticize it from within, so to speak. But especially the WASP population in Southern California was, in my day, culturally desolate. But I lived in an area which was about 40% Jewish, including quite a few people who were refugees from Europe. Some of you may have heard of the conductor Andre Previn. He was my friend in high school, and his family came from Europe. Thus, a breath of cultural light was shed in this otherwise dark atmosphere. And I learned about classical music and literature and a great many things that gave me better preparation for going to Harvard than my school education, probably. But among other things, I was exposed to Marxism. And many of these refugees were Marxists. And I thought Marxism was great. It made all the sense in the world to me at that time. I had 2 years in the army at a time when there was no fighting, the war was over, and I was reading Marx and Engels. I don't know if the army knew that, but that's what I was doing. And when I went to Harvard in 47, almost immediately I met members of the undergraduate Communist Party, were some of the smartest people I've ever known in my life, and many of them are now eminent professors. I won't name their names, but that's what they became. That all went very well, except that some of my good friends at Harvard and I would read the Daily Worker and laugh because some of the things it said were so weird and ludicrous. The party turned out to be not exactly what I thought it would be by reading Marx and Engels, and so I was expelled from the Communist Party. I don't want to tell you in detail because it would take too long, but I did get in trouble later because although I had left the party in disgust and was certainly strongly anti-Stalinist, I refused to give names of other people who could be guilty of nothing but speech and association, which are guaranteed by the First Amendment. And so my first appointment at Harvard was actually problematic, but I won't go into that. It's all written into the New York Review of Books over the years. But there I was, as a graduate student, quite uncertain what to do. And yet I knew religion was terribly important. I thought Marxism was a kind of religion. It turned out to be a false god, but it was nonetheless a profoundly ethical movement for millions of young people in the world in those days. And it was when I was at the Institute for Islamic Studies at McGill that I wrote the first draft of Religious Evolution, an essay that was published in 1964. So from the very beginning, this topic was, I was trying to understand the world in a very strange way, having been grown up in a very conventional atmosphere, having been exposed to the wide world and the amazing cultural effervescence of Harvard in those years, where most of my fellow students, like I, had been had a couple of years before they went back. Anyway, and I also had a need for faith. And I thought two things. I don't want to go back to the mainline Protestant tradition because it's just all talk. I need two things, either silence or liturgy. And so I first chose the Quakers. And I went there in the summertime when most people were away, and I loved it. It was really quiet. But when people came back from their summer vacation, they started talking all the time. And when one woman got up and she said, as I was reading in the Reader's Digest, and I thought, you're supposed to talk when the Holy Spirit is speaking to you, not because you read the Reader's Digest. And then I decided I better try liturgy. And I went to Episcopal Church just off of Harvard Square. And what was it? It was morning prayer. It was before the 1979 prayer book. It wasn't liturgy. So I was lost. Catholicism was never an option to me. It was just too far from everything I grew up with. But I loved Catholicism. And when I was working at Berkeley, I worked most closely with the Jesuit school and to some extent the Franciscan and the Dominican schools. And so I ended up, after 1979, with the Episcopal Church, and so I could have the Mass, but not have to deal with the hierarchy and the Pope. And so the center of my personal faith is the Eucharist, that moment in which I really feel physically I'm part of a member of the body of Christ. That's the center of my piety. But I have studied religions all over the world. I was exposed intensely to Islam for 2 years in an institute where half of every teacher and every student were Muslims from all over the world. I made some long-lasting friends with Muslims. I studied Mahayana Buddhism because I was a Japan scholar, became deeply involved with Zen Buddhism, and actually served on the board of the San Francisco Zen Center at a period of crisis when they wanted me. Brother David Steindl-Rast, a Benedictine monk, also was on the board when I was. And they knew that we were both Christians, but they also knew that we had a deep feeling for Zen, and they wanted us on the board, and so we served. And I must say, part of me is very Confucian. And some people have told me that if Dick Madsen, who is a longtime China person, and I, a longtime Japan person, had not been among the co-authors of Habits of the Heart, it would not have had the sensitivity it did, because there is an element in Confucianism of such profound sensitivity to interpersonal relations for the very immediacy of social life. I think Mencius was very similar to Durkheim, actually. There's something in Confucianism that understands society in a very deep way. So I've been very open to other religions. I'm not a relativist. I have a place which I know is my place. And I can certainly say some things are bad, some elements of religion, and certainly some elements of Christian religion horrify me, astound me. And there are very bad things in almost every religion. So it's not a question of all rose to the same thing, blah, blah, blah. No. The insights and truths of various religions are quite different. The Zen sees things that most Christians don't see. Confucianism is sensitive things that Christians and Muslims don't see. So it isn't a question of all leading to the same truth, although there are deep interconnections at some level. Ethical universalism is true of all the great traditions. But it's precisely in their difference that they're valuable, because they open us up to alternatives. So Harlan, you deserve it. You asked for a question that had required a long answer.
Thank you. I recall a question that Bill Moyers asked of you in a 1988 interview. He wondered how you sustained sort of an intellectual life in the academy on religion when the academy oftentimes thinks has thought of religion as either old-fashioned or could be explained away. And what has it been like to be so committed to the study of religion in the academy?
To be a practicing Christian on the Berkeley faculty is to be in the belly of the beast. I once had a student come to me and say he wanted to help me understand Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell. I said, and why did you come to me? He said, well, my professor said, that's the kind of person you are. And after Habits of the Heart was published, I had a seminar, or no, it was a large seminar, it was about 300 people at the University of Michigan on a Saturday morning. I didn't know you'd get 300 professors to anything on a Saturday morning. They mostly were from the professional schools, not the arts and sciences faculty. But one, the commentator, a well-known historian, whom I won't name, said, on the basis of the religion chapter of Habits of the Heart, which if you read it, I think you won't understand why he said this. He said, Robert Bellah should not be allowed to teach at a state university. He should have to teach at Notre Dame. Well, I didn't think that was bad. I know a lot of smart people at Notre Dame. Then he said, no, he should have to teach at Bob Jones University. This idiot didn't know that Bob Jones doesn't let you on campus unless they screen you, and they would surely have screened me out. I could never set foot in Bob Jones University. So the prejudice against religion is the one prejudice that is still okay in the academic world. And indeed, in Berkeley in general, to go to church is countercultural. I sort of like that. I'd rather go to church counterculturally than just because everybody else does. Let me say one more thing that I've just come across this week that really kind of astounds me and that sheds a little light on my youthful interest in Marxism. The Pew Foundation. Nothing could be more conservative than Pew. Pew is absolutely rock solid conservative. They don't twist their surveys for any ideological purpose. They asked a question they've been asking for the last 2 or 3 years. Which is the better economic system, socialism or capitalism? What did they find? Well, predictably, they found of Americans, voting age Americans, about 2/3 said capitalism. 1/3 said socialism. That's already interesting, 1/3. But those between 18 and 30, 49% said socialism and 46% said capitalism. Why? Who is advocating socialism in America today? Why? Listen to those debates. Listen to those guys. They're always calling Obama a socialist, right? I think it's backfiring. Especially young people are saying, gee, if the things they don't like are socialism, I probably would like it. I don't know. But there's a danger in this situation of the way language is used in our political life. Anyway, just a footnote. Okay.
Well, enough about you right now. So I'm going to talk a little bit about us.
It wasn't about me. That's about American young people.
Right. Good point. So, as you know, we're engaged in a big history project here, which has an impact on our whole curriculum to a large degree. Obviously, you've framed your whole book in the framework of big history, heard that tonight. Can you say a little bit about what you think is significant about doing that in a university like this in terms of its impact and its approach to liberal education?
Let me put this in a little context because of my 2 visits to China in November and December of last year. There was tremendous interest in my new book. Only a few people had copies, but some people had already read it. But when I offered to speak about global civil society or other things, no, we want to hear about the book. We want to hear about religious evolution. There is now a negotiation between Harvard University Press and Beijing University Press for a Chinese translation, which will be the second translation because there's already a contract for a Korean translation. Why? Why? I mean, there's some talk of a German and an Italian translation, but it's not nearly as far along. Because the Chinese, at least, feel my book takes them seriously. Equal treatment. It's not just Israel and Greece, not just the rise of the West. I'm saying China and India are as important as Greece and Israel. And that means so much to them. Because in many ways, they are profoundly influenced by the international human rights regime, and they want democracy. And they're not against Western culture in any absolute sense. But they know they have a great tradition, and that most Westerners don't know that. But that I know that. So I think teaching big history with profound respect to all the great traditions and taking them all seriously is helping people enter the world in which we live. This is no longer a world in which the West rules. The two great powers in the earth today are China and the United States. And I think ultimately we will make it or not make it only if China and the United States can work together for global equality and global ecological change. So I think big history is where we are at this stage of human history, and what we need to have the kind of understanding that can open our doors. Not this constant nonsense about how America's the greatest nation in history, blah, 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 blah. America's a very great nation. Who on earth can say what is the greatest nation in history? Is this a time for arrogance? For our narcissistic love of ourselves? No, it's a time to be open to the fact that there are many great cultures in the world and that we need to understand why. So I think big history has an extremely practical consequence, but also it's so interesting.
So the question I have in my mind, as I've read your book and students have read your book and heard you speak on occasion, there's something about this book and the journey from the mid-1960 article, Religious Evolution, to now. Can you say a little bit about that, and how has the book changed you in writing it, or has it changed you in some way?
Let me say one more thing about China. I signed a lot of copies of the Chinese translation of Habits of the Heart.
Really?
The Chinese are interested in understanding us, and they think that book helps them. I don't think Americans are reading any parallel to Habits of the Heart about China. Thank you. I got hijacked into American studies because of having published that essay on civil religion in America, which led to The Broken Covenant, which led to Habits of the Heart, which led to The Good Society. When you have a large audience that wants you to speak all the time and wants to your next book, 500,000 people more than that bought Habits of the Heart, you have to respond. It's partly your citizenship duty. Even though in my deepest heart I wanted to work all my life on religious evolution. So finally in 1997 when I retired, I was able to give all my time for 13 years to this book. How did it change? It didn't change in the overall structure. I think that is pretty much the same as the article in 1964. What changed was an enormous richness of detail, which changed the attitude towards my work of Jonathan Z. Smith, who many of you have never heard of, but he's a very important figure in religious studies, a great comparatist. He thought my article in 64 was shallow. He thought my recent book is a masterpiece of scholarship. And I'll tell you what Jonathan Z. Smith did when he got a copy of my book. He turned to the notes and read all the notes. This guy knows what he's talking about. So the big change is just an enormous amount of fine-grained detail. And really, to tell the story well, you have to do that. You have to get in the trenches. That's why so much of what's done in psychological, evolutionary psychology is so shallow, is they don't know anything about religion. They have these theories that are based on their own preconceptions. And I think only people who really, really get down and try to understand what's going on can make a contribution at this point. But that takes time. Who can spend 13 years writing one book?
I'll ask one more question. I want to make sure the audience has a chance to ask you some questions. What I was after in that is something about how did you change yourself? Did it change you? I can remember after you writing chapter two, you dealt with all this science. You said, this was a struggle for me to not only understand the science, but also its implications for me and my own identity. And I think we see that with our students as well, as they try to absorb what this new story means to them, given all the other stories that they've had throughout their lives. Did it change you?
Well, I think you saw how it affected me in the talk I gave. Because all that was very much personally felt. That sense that we are not alone, that we wouldn't exist without being part of this whole story, that every capacity we have is only the development of capacities that go back millions of years. I remember early on reading Derek Bickerton, a great evolutionary linguist, who said, if you want to understand language, you have to look back at the earliest species in evolutionary time, because they are already sentient, and language is only a very radical development of consciousness, which is coterminous with life. And that was very, very important to me. And I do feel, I mean, many, many scholars, particularly humanists, are so prejudiced against other species. I mean, really. So I think we need to not only understand other cultures, we need to understand that we not only should like other species, but we need other species. We wouldn't be here without them. It's part of who we are. It's part of our identity.
So I'd like to open up to the audience for questions right now. I was going to ask Bob just give us a 3-minute version of his book, a thesis of his book, but I think that would have been...
No, I can't
a little
do
too
that
difficult.
Anyway.
So let's go ahead and take questions from the audience. I don't know if there were cards that were passed out, but I know there's a microphone that should be over there. So is there a question? Straight from the audience, we don't need the cards. If you have just stand up and ask the question, be fine. Over here? Yes.
How do I get hold of your 64 article?
How do you get hold of your 64 article?
It's published in two places. University of California Press publishes a book of mine called Beyond Belief, which has that article. It's still in print. And Duke University Press just in 2005 published the Robert Bella Reader, and it's available in that reader too.
And just to remind you that there, his current book is on sale in the lobby, and afterwards he will be autographing the book, so do get a copy and we'll hang around at the end. Yeah, question right down here.
It draws heavily on chapter two of the book, but this particular talk has not been published. I wrote it especially for this event.
So
I'll send Harlan an email attachment, and if you have an email, he can forward it to you.
I think we have been videoing this. I'm not, or certainly we've been recording as well, but I'll give me your card and I'll make sure you get it. Back here, yes.
In your survey of religions, I'm wondering how you personally settled on Christianity as the form for your own religious practice.
Probably inertia. I mean, that's what I grew up with. I don't think that's a bad reason. You know, after Habits of the Heart was published, and maybe this made that critic at Michigan have some justification, students used to come into my office and say, what church should I join? And of course I said, it's not my business to tell you what church or any church to join. That's for you to find out on your own. And then they said, oh, but some help, some help. So I said, well, were you raised in any tradition? Because that might be a place to start. Unless they had some horrible experience and rejected it radically, why not? All the traditions have great resources. Much as I don't really care too much for Calvin, I know he was one of the greatest theologians who ever lived. And if you want to be a Calvinist, I have Calvinist friends. So I tried to encourage them to seek whatever was close at hand. And of course, through Zen Buddhism, I've known many converts from Christianity to Buddhism, which is fine too. If they want to convert, that's fine. That's really my answer.
Yeah, over here.
Professor Bella, another angle on that same topic. If you were once a Marxist, you probably once thought that religion was the opiate of the masses. Using that kind of language, how did you change from religion being an opiate to being a true fulfillment? We don't have to talk about specific religious traditions to address that one, perhaps.
In that passage where Marx says religion is the opium of the people, he begins by saying religion is the heart of a heartless world. And there's another line. Do you remember the other line?
It's the cry of the...
Yes, it is the cry of the oppressed. Uh-huh. Marx had a more complicated view of religion than just that one line about opium would imply. And of course, some Marxist scholars have been very sympathetic with the fact that religion is often involved in social reform and social change. I suppose I did think that religion was at least not as true as Marxism in those days. I didn't worry about it too much. And obviously something in my earlier life stuck with me, because when Marxism failed, I thought of Jesus. I was to that extent still a Christian, whatever I might have thought. And the interesting thing is, Confucianism is often claimed to be a secular faith. And that's why Marxism succeeded in China, because Confucianism, blah, blah, blah. And Confucianism does have the notion of an ideal society. And Confucianism does hope for a good ruler, a good king. However, in practice, Confucians always found the existing kings to be terrible. And Confucians, though they ran the country, also when talking to one another privately, were horribly critical of what was going on. And sometimes they would tell the emperor off, even if they got their heads chopped off for it. So somehow Confucianism has a this-worldly salvation, which is never realized. And yet the faith is not lost. Whereas I think Marxism, when it's clear that socialism is a travesty and that the so-called socialism is just another form of inequality, or in China, a new form of neoliberal capitalism. By the way, if you think China is Marxist, think again. One of the big shocks in China was to discover that nobody studies Marx and Engels. That would be far too dangerous. What they call Marxism in China is a highly edited quotes from Mao Zedong, plus Deng Xiaoping and Hu Jintao, not Marxism. In fact, somebody asked a professor of Marxism, and it's taught at every level in every school, what do you think of the Communist Manifesto? And the professor of Marxism said, and what is the Communist Manifesto? I'm telling you. Anyway, Marxism fails because it doesn't produce what it's supposed to. Why does Confucianism not fail when it doesn't give us the ideal kingdom? Because there is a profound focus in the entire Confucian tradition on self-cultivation, on spiritual practice, on ethical relations to every single human being. And yes, there is a distorted hierarchical androcentric version. But at its depth, there is a sense that all human beings are at one. There's a deep egalitarianism in China, and it has to do in part with Confucianism. So there is a degree of personal faith, and that's why it's wrong to think Confucianism is simply secular. It has a powerful religious dimension. If you study the great figures in Confucian history, above all, of course, Confucius himself and Mencius and Xunzi, you'll see some extraordinarily profound spiritual thought. So that's the answer to that one.
So we'll take one more question.
Yes, good evening, Doctor. We've had religion through the whole of our human evolution. And religion in many occasions, or darn near most occasions, has been inhuman and cruel, and there's been a lot of not good things done in the name of religion. Do you think perhaps if we did not have religion during our human evolution, but learning, that man in fact might be a better beast today?
I think religion is a dimension of human existence that is as essential to who we are as human beings as economics or politics. Tell me how good economic systems have been in human history, when in most of human history, the great proportion of the population lived in crushing poverty as peasants, and a tiny 1% or 5% or some very small percent were living well. But tell me about how wonderful economics has been in human history, or politics. Most of the history of politics is bloody tyranny, and half the world is still in bloody tyranny. That religion will have evil as well as good has to do with the fact that human beings are very complicated creatures. I mean, Christians talk about sin, but every religion knows that there is evil in the heart of human beings, that we live in this constant struggle between our better instincts and our worse instincts. We can be good people, and we can be concerned with the whole world, or we can just think of ourselves alone and accumulate as much as we can just for us. But this is nothing to do. Religion did not cause that. Religion participates in the evil of the world because necessarily it is part of the world. I used to open my most frequently taught course in the sociology of religion by saying, religion is responsible for some of the noblest things human beings have ever done, and religion is responsible for some of the most terrible things humans have ever done. I'm not apologizing for religion. I'm not saying religion is a good thing per se, always and everywhere. I think religion is inescapable, that we wouldn't be human without it. But that it's good sometimes and bad sometimes is obvious to any student of the history of religion.
Bob, thank you very much. I feel like we've just sort of put our toe in the water here of what we could be talking to you about tonight. But just give us a little sense of maybe what next. What are you writing next? Where is it going? And what do you think the message is going to be, or do you have that yet happening?
Well, I know I can't write another 700-page book because I'm 85, and besides, I stopped 2,000 years ago, and there's far more written in the last 2,000 years than everything else put together. So it would take me another 100 years, and I don't think I'm going to be given another 100 years. But I am trying to write what I call a kind of essay, which will not be in the kind of detail that this book is, but will focus on the question of what is modernity. And my tentative title is the Modern Project in the Light of Human Evolution. And really some of what I said tonight in my talk is related to the next book. Because I see, some people think with culture, evolution is over. Culture is just another part of evolution. Culture is a product of our biological capacities. And evolution and natural selection goes on apace, brutally apace, if you look at the world in which we live, in which the struggle for existence is everywhere visible. And even the survival of the fittest, awful term to be used to justify evil, but unfortunately it's a reality. And so what I'm trying to do in the next book is bring all the wisdom I could gather from the whole past of this book to focus on the modern period and how recent modernity is. I don't date modernity from 1500 or 1700, but from 1800. I think it's only with the rise of industrialism that we have modernity. It's only when we begin to use energy at an ever-increasing speed. In 1750, Beijing and London were equally livable civilized cities. It would be very hard to say London was better than Beijing. But from 1800 on, something happened that changed the world, and not necessarily all for the good. And we've got to understand it, and we certainly don't understand it, because all kinds of ideological considerations cloud our mind. So the next book is really a more practical book. It's kind of an effort to say, where are we now? And what do we have to do now in the light of all that I know, both biologically and culturally? A small task, but I hope to live long enough to finish it. I'm pretty healthy, so.
Well, we thank you very much. Thank you all for coming.
All right. Thank you very much for listening to tonight's ILS lecture on radio.dominican.edu. Dr. Robert Bell, our speaker, from Angelico Hall. Stuart Horn signing off. Another ILS worldwide broadcast on radio.dominican.edu.